Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Saturday marked the 45th anniversary of the killing of Black Panther leader George Jackson at San Quentin Prison. Nearly a half a century later, his life and legacy are commemorated by many as part of a month of fasting and resistance called Black August. The coalition cobbled together after the disputed 2014 Afghan election may be falling apart as a power struggle deepens. Almost 15 years after the brutal U.S. invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, the Taliban are now active in more of the country than they were even in 2001. The United Nations has admitted its role in causing the worst cholera outbreak in recent history in Haiti. It's killed almost 10,000 Haitians to date. But why was a report on the outbreak suppressed for almost a year, and does it only scratch the surface of UN abuses in Haiti? But first we turn to Black August. We are joined by Eddie Conway. He is a journalist with the Real News Network, who is a leading member of the Maryland branch of the Black Panther Party, and he was a political prisoner for 44 years. Welcome back, Eddie Conway.
Thanks for having me.
Saturday marked the 45th anniversary of the killing of Black Panther activist George Jackson at San Quentin Prison. Nearly half a century later, his life and legacy are commemorated by many as part of a month of resistance called Black August. Talk about what Black August is. Talk about George Jackson. Talk about what happened 45 years ago Saturday.
Okay, well, Black August actually goes back throughout history. A number of revolts took place in August, and Nat Turner probably being one of the main ones that most people can identify with. But Black August represents for us in the Black Liberation Movement and for people fighting for human rights, that period that we can identify with George Jackson. George Jackson actually was assassinated in August of 71. I believe his brother was assassinated in August also of 70. Even later on, I believe in 82, Huey P. Newton also was killed in August. And a number of activities have taken place. And I think people have decided that that's the month that we should recognize the resistance movement throughout our hundreds of years of resisting slavery and Jim Crow and so on in America. George Jackson was significant because of his ability to analyze what fascism was and his ability to bring together people from all ethnic groups in the prison system to organize the change conditions in the prison system. His book, Blood in My Eye, and the other book, Soledad Brothers, is a book that was used throughout the 60s and the 70s, throughout the prison systems in America, to raise the consciousness of prisoners and to change their behavior from resisting the system in terms of criminal activity to actually resisting the system in terms of organizing revolutionary activities. And probably one of his major achievements that has since went a little awry is developing the Black guerrilla family to protect prisoners in the prison systems and to go out in the community and work in the community. Along with the assassination of George Jackson, COINTELPRO has usurped that movement, or at least disrupted it or misdirected it, so that it's no longer that entity that George Jackson tried to create in terms of protecting and organizing and building the community.
That's Eddie Conway. We're talking to him from Baltimore, Maryland, about Black August, about the 45th anniversary, which took place on Saturday, of the killing. the execution, the assassination of political prisoner George Jackson in San Quentin prison. Eddie Conway himself was in prison for 44 years as a political prisoner. Eddie, I was in Rochester, New York, not far from Attica Prison at the time of George Jackson's killing. I remember it vividly, as all of us who are of this age would. August 21st, his brother, as you mentioned, George Jonathan Jackson, was killed August 7th in 1970. A few weeks after George Jackson was killed, on September 9th, 1971, the prisoners at Attica rose up. They seized the D block. Perhaps a quarter to a half of the prisoners took control of the prison and held the prison from September 9th to September 13th, when Governor Nelson Rockefeller at that time ordered the retaking of the prison. And there was one of the great massacres of people that took place as the prison was retaken. Scores of people were killed. At first, the prisoners were blamed for the death of hostages who the media and the government said they had slit their throats. But in fact, the hostages, the prison guards who had been taken hostage in the rebellion, they too had been killed by the police fire, the state troopers fire, when the retaking of the prison. Talk about Attica, and talk about, if you would, because you were there as a leading member of the Maryland Black Panther Party, about the interconnectedness of the resistance movement inside the prison with the larger movement for black liberation that was taking place and sweeping and impacting on United States society at that time.
Okay, well, one of the things that at that time I was in the Maryland Penitentiary when Attica and when George Jackson was assassinated. And you're right, I think 28 prisoners were killed by the guards in New York, and I believe 11 guards were killed. And all 39 deaths obviously were blamed on the prisoners. But one of the things that happened during that period was that the prison population became increasingly politicalized, and the consciousness was raised because there was so much activity in the community, and so many people were coming into the prison system from the community's activity, and they were bringing their consciousness, and they were bringing their literature, and they were bringing organizing skills inside the prison system across America with them. And so various formations formed, white groups, black groups, brown groups, et cetera, that were conscious inside the prison and had made a conscious decision to work together and create united fronts. And I think Attica is the results of that work, not just with political people from the community, but across the board. They created that kind of united front that said that, in fact, I think the slogan that came out of that was, we are humans. We don't want to be treated like animals. And that was the conditions that we were living in at that time. And that was the conditions that George Jackson was fighting against. And so it was a common kind of thread throughout the United States that prisoners were being treated like animals, which today has revisited. Even after all that resistance and change and reform, the prison system has slipped back into that same condition of dehumanizing people. So there's an increasing amount of political awareness developing in the prison system today across the nation. So we can look forward to seeing more George Jackson's. His legacy is that a lot of people are coming in his footsteps and demanding to be treated like human beings.
That's the voice of Eddie Conway. He was a political prisoner in the United States for 44 years. Now a journalist with the Real News Network in Baltimore. We're talking about Black August. And as Eddie mentioned, Black August, or August, was selected to mark both the resistance, the oppression and the resistance of people against racism. The first Africans were brought to Jamestown, Virginia, as slaves, as enslaved people in August 1619, Gabriel Presser's slave rebellion in August 30th, 1800, Nat Turner, August 21st, 1831, that historic slave revolt, the same day, in fact, that George Jackson was assassinated. Eddie Conway, the struggle goes through ups and downs. It goes through ebbs and flows. What happened 45 years ago was when there was a peak almost of the Black liberation movement that had flowed out of the civil rights movement that emerged as a nationwide, not just a Southern-based movement, and a movement that was connected to the anti-colonial and anti-imperialist struggles around the world that were taking place at that time 45 years ago. Then there was an ebb in the struggle. There was a diminution of the struggle. But there is, in the last few years, with the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, a return of militant street protests and mass movement kind of formations around the country. Talk about that. What are the lessons of the 60s and early 70s that are most relevant from your point of view? I know there's too many to talk about in a short amount of time. Most relevant for today's emerging new generation of activists?
Well, I think probably the most important and the most significant is to be educated, to get that education, to look at your history, look at the history that came before you, the other organizations, see the mistakes that they made, see how they operated, and see how they were attacked and disrupted. One of the things that happens, and I think young people understand it today, is to move away from that hierarchy of organizing with the cult of personalities, of big leaders up at the top and everybody else follow in footstep. I think young people are organizing horizontally. Everybody has a chance at leadership. Everybody's got something, some input in the direction in which they were organized in. And so that's an important piece, because a lot of times leaders can either be locked up and then other people can be put in a place that can misdirect or mislead what's going on. The other piece of that is that stay within the boundaries of organizing about building, about improving the community, about creating institutions that will work in the interests of the people in the community. And if a fight occur as a result of that, or protests or resistance in as a result of that, it's in the name of the community, in the name of the people, in the interests of the community, in the interests of the people. And then people will in turn support it. And even if they don't support it, they will understand why there's protest. And so that's an important, I think those three pieces, get your political education, get your understanding of history, organize so that you have a horizontal in which they are. I think the Occupy Wall Street, along with the current Black Lives Matter movement, along with the environmentalist movement and other movements, the movement for gender rights, et cetera, they're organizing horizontally, and I think that's a really good thing. And just, you've got to be part of the community. If you're organizing and you're talking about changing conditions and Black lives or whatever lives might matter, you need to be down there where those lives are and impact them.
Right. That's Eddie Conway. Eddie, I want to ask you about your own story. I heard you speak in Philadelphia in the first day of the Democratic National Convention. There was a forum held there to demand that President Obama take action to give to release, to provide clemency for Leonard Peltier and other prisoners in the federal prison system. Of course, there are other political prisoners who are in state prisons. People in the United States and people around the world certainly may not even know that there are political prisoners in the United States. I'd like you to talk about that thing, but I also want, if you wouldn't mind, to talk about how did you survive 44 years in prison? How did you keep it together? And how long were you in solitary confinement?
Okay, well, I guess the first thing and the most important thing is that, yes, there's dozens of political prisoners still in prison after 45, 50 years still today from the Black Liberation Movement and the anti-imperialist fight and the resistance against oppression for Native Americans. So it's important that people go to those websites, find out who they are, and give them support. The other thing is that for me, it was the support that came from the community, from people around the world that helped helped me to survive, helped me to resist. But it was also the fact that I continued to work with the community and continued to work inside the prison system for change. Those things, doing the work and staying involved and having support, all of that stuff is like very important for our political prisoners. And we're having more people be joining the ranks of political prisoners today because of the activism. And so we need to focus on building a strong network to support that.
In the last minute, Eddie Conway, I want to ask you, when President Obama was elected president in November 2008, it was, of course, a historic event that it was, I think, impossible to have perceived or believed even 5 years or maybe even 10 months before the election that, given the racist character of the United States, that a black person, a black man, someone named Barack Hussein Obama could be elected president. But he was elected president. And then the system said, see, we've now reached a post-racial America. In our last 45 seconds, just talk about that sort of concept, if you would.
Yeah, well, we haven't reached anything. I think he was elected because he could serve the interests of the American ruling class. He helped to recolonize Africa. He helped destroy and in fact, he increased the amount of wars around the world. He had the ability to operate like that because there was no protest from the left or from the black community because of his color and because of his imagery. So I think pretty much he served their interests and not the interests of the people on the ground.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Eddie Conway. He was a political prisoner in the United States for 44 years. We've been talking about the Black August commemorations taking place all around the country throughout the month of August. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The United Nations has admitted its role in causing the worst cholera outbreak in recent history in Haiti, an outbreak that has killed almost 10,000 people to date. But why was a report on the outbreak suppressed for almost a year? And does it only scratch the surface of UN abuses in Haiti? We are joined by Kim Ives. He is a contributing editor to Haiti Liberté. And by Sienna Marope. She is an attorney at the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Welcome, Kim and Sienna.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks.
Sienna, let's start with you. Let's look at the UN report that was released. What does it admit about the UN's own role? And is there anything particularly surprising in it for those of you who have followed this outbreak, this tragedy, for the last years?
Well, so there has been a UN report by an independent expert, Philip Alston, which prompted the UN's admission of its own responsibility. We haven't seen that report yet. It's not public. But the UN's admission is a huge shift in position and a huge victory for the people, particularly the people in Haiti who have been marching and writing to the UN and trying to bring the UN to port for the last 6 years.
Kim Ives, talk about what the report actually says. What was the UN's role? Of course, for you, Kim Ives and Sienna, people who are following it closely, of course, for the Haitian people who know it firsthand, maybe nothing in the report is new, but talk about it for the broader audience, if you would. What happened?
Well, I, too, have not seen the report. It is still secret. It apparently has been seen by Jonathan Katz, who wrote the piece breaking the story for the New York Times. But basically, this, I think I'd also say, and Sienna, maybe you can tell us more about it. I think it comes on the same day that the U.S. Federal Appeals Court upheld the United Nations immunity from the claim that the IJDH has brought on behalf of 5,000 cholera victims. Essentially, lower court had ruled earlier that the UN had immunity, and the appeals court has upheld that. And of course, this is at the core of the whole issue. Can the UN allow its sewage of its troops to flow into the headwaters of Haiti's largest river, spark the world's worst cholera epidemic, which has killed 10,000 and sickened a million people, and there's no end in sight. Throughout the whole thing, act as if they had no role in that. And even this admission, I have to say, is I think, going to spark demonstrations, because they don't come out clearly and say, yes, we were responsible. They say, well, we have to look at our role, our you know, what we played in this, as if it was maybe something even tangential. No, this is, I think, going to be a case where the pressure has to be kept on to keep the UN truthful and live up to what has been raised as a hope that they are going to take responsibility.
Sienna, at least the reports about what the report says include that the, as Kim alluded to, that the UN UN troops and UN peacekeepers there poured inadequately treated sewage wastewater into Haitian public canals. They ignored urgent laboratory warnings that some of the tainted liquid contained fecal contamination. They ignored maintenance of water treatment plants at UN peacekeeper camps, failed to inspect water treatment plants as well as septic tanks as required, skip vital chlorination of wastewater treatment sites, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, was it just neglect? Talk about why this kind of conduct would happen, and then, of course, why the UN would tolerate it.
What's clear is that there was absolute systematic disregard for the most basic standards of sanitation, and that this continued actually for years following the initial cholera outbreak. A quick point of clarification here is that there are two separate reports that recently come out. There's an internal audit report that shows exactly these problems that you've been speaking about, Brian, and that is public. And then there's a separate report by a human rights expert that has been reported in the Times but is not yet public. But this first report, this audit report, documents really staggering and shocking waste mismanagement that continued not only in the lead up to the cholera epidemic, but through till December 2014, at a time that cholera had already killed almost 9,000 people. Now, this just demonstrates systematic disregard for Haitians' lives, frankly, and institutionally within the organisation, an inability to reform and take this problem seriously from the field level in Haiti all the way up to the highest levels of the UN, including the Secretary General.
Kim Ives, why was the UN, why is the UN in Haiti?
Well, the UN is in Haiti to essentially keep down the revolutionary aspirations of the Haitian people, who have been fighting for justice and democracy really since the fall of the Duvalier dictatorship in 1986, 30 years ago. 5 years after that, a nationalist, democratic nationalist president was elected, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and he was immediately overthrown within 8 months by a U.S.-backed coup. And again, he was overthrown 13 years later in 2004 by another U.S.-backed coup. And after the first coup, they put in a U.S. force to occupy the country, which then passed it off to the UN as to act as sort of a proxy. Eventually, the UN force in 2000 was taken out, but Aristide came back. So when they came back in after Aristide was overthrown again on February 29th, 2004, they were supposed to come in for just 6 months. But here we are 12 years later, and the UN force is still there. And they're there essentially to keep down the Haitian people and act as a, in place of the Haitian army that once used to govern Haiti. Aristide removed that army in 1995, and now the UN force acts as the putative Haitian army to keep the people in check.
Sienna Marope, let me ask you about the other problems that have been caused by the perpetual presence of UN peacekeepers for all of these long years that Kim Ives talked about. It's not just about waste management and the terrible tragedy of the cholera outbreak that took so many thousands of lives. There have been other social problems. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes. As Kim mentioned, MINUSTAH's presence in Haiti is incredibly problematic. There really isn't a basis for it to be there apart from to put down popular rebellion. And while it has been there, it has consistently violated patients' human rights, both in its operations in poor neighborhoods that have recklessly killed a large number of civilians in supposed anti-gang operations. And it has also committed a lot of sexual abuse by peacekeepers. As we know, peacekeeper sexual abuse is a worldwide problem, and it's certainly a problem in Haiti that's very pervasive, both rapes, abuse of young children, and also exploitative relationships by peacekeepers, where they then father children and abandon the Haitian mothers extremely destitute and unable to care for the child. So that's the context of MINUSTAH's presence in Haiti. And then you add to that the cholera epidemic, which has killed now almost 10,000 people, possibly many times more than that, according to studies by Doctors Without Borders, and which the UN has stonewalled about for 6 years. So this is a big change of position that we see now from the UN on cholera, but Haitians are rightly sceptical about MINUSTAH and the UN generally. And so the real test will be what happens next.
Well, talking about what happens next, Kim Ives, we have, of course, the UN occupying force there, the peacekeeper, so-called. Again, that eliminates Haiti's sovereignty, its ability to control its own destiny. But it does have a political system. What's the current state of the Haitian political landscape? Is there political uncertainty at the moment? How does this impact on the country's ability to develop out of the current crisis?
Well, it's held the country in a headlock, essentially, for these past 12 years. There is an interim president right now, Jocelyn Privert, who has called elections, or his electoral council has called elections for October 9th to essentially redo elections done by former President Michel Martelly in 2015. Martelly, to remind listeners, was a president who arrived in power very questionably, controversially, through the intervention of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who essentially forced the Haitian president at the time, René Préval, to put Martelly in the runoff, which eventually he won in 2011. But he never held any elections, and so the elections he finally held or was forced to hold at the end of 2015 as he was leaving power were marred by fraud and violence, and they're being redone. But this is going to be a real moment of truth. Can the Haitian people wrest back their sovereignty and their electoral sovereignty above all, and hold elections which the UN does not intervene in and essentially foil through their supposed oversight of ballot boxes and so forth? So we're really at a key moment in Haitian history with respect to these UN occupations, which have plagued it over the past two decades.
Sienna Marop, a key moment in Haitian history. Of course, the Haitian people carried out the first successful slave revolution more than 200 years ago, became the vanguard, really, for the struggle against the enslavement of people, the enslavement of African peoples, became a beacon for those struggling for freedom and the abolition of slavery in the United States. And at the same time, and since then, Haiti's been subjected to so much interference on the part of the United States and others. Country has right now is suffering great impoverishment. How does Haiti and how do the Haitian people regain control over their own destiny?
Well, what needs to happen is a respect for Haitian human rights, first and foremost, and their sovereignty. And there really is no need for a MINUSTAH presence in Haiti, and certainly no credibility of the UN presence in Haiti. You know, you drive down the street in Haiti and you go to protests and there'll be signs saying MINUSTAH cholera. So I think the first step is really for international organizations, the UN and countries like the US, to respect Haitians' human rights, including their right to self-determination, to choose their own elections, but also their basic human rights that were violated by the cholera epidemic, and to take steps to start making that right by ensuring that Haitians are listened to, that compensation is provided to cholera victims, that there's investment in water and sanitation to eliminate cholera from Haiti, and also that the UN publicly apologizes to the Haitian people for the systematic disregard for their lives that has occurred over the last 6 years.
That's Sienna Marope. She is an attorney with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. We're talking about the fact that the United Nations belatedly has taken responsibility for having caused, or at least being somewhat responsible. We'll see what it really says at the end of the day, but certainly played a major, if not the role, in causing the cholera epidemic that's taken the lives of 10,000 Haitian people. We have about 2.5 minutes left. Kim Ives, I want to ask you, you mentioned about the Clintons. Of course, Hillary Clinton is contesting with Donald Trump to be the 2016 presidential in the 2016 presidential campaign. She is the likely next president of the United States. What will that mean for Haiti?
Haitians think it's going to be very bad. I mean, neither Trump nor Clinton can be really considered a friend. And the Clintons have played a terrible role in Haiti as far as leading so-called rebuilding efforts after the January 2010 earthquake. Hillary Clinton's, we could say, centerpiece of post-earthquake help was to build a sweatshop in the north of Haiti, which isn't even going very well. This was far from the earthquake zone. And essentially, Bill Clinton acted as some sort of a proconsul in the country for about a year and a half after the earthquake. So the Clintons have a very bad track record in Haiti. And I think if she becomes president, as it appears she will, this is not good news for Haiti.
Sienna Marope, in the last minute, you are an attorney with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. What is that?
The Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti is a small U.S.-based nonprofit that works to advance the rule of law and human rights in Haiti. We're the partner organization of Haiti's oldest human rights firm, the Bureau des Avocats Internationaux. And together with our Haitian partner, BAI, we've been accompanying cholera victims for the last 6 years in their struggle to get justice from the United Nations.
Okay, and Kim Ives, just a last word from you. We have about 30 seconds left on the same subject. Talk about Haiti Liberté, if you would.
Well, Haiti Liberté is the largest Haitian weekly based in New York and Port-au-Prince. We distribute throughout the Haitian diaspora and in Haiti and essentially have the watchwords of justice and transparency as we try to hold that high in the face of what is a very difficult situation in Haiti.
All right. We have been speaking with Sienna Marope. She is an attorney with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Also with Kim Ives. He's the contributing editor of Haiti Liberté. We've been talking about the fact that the United Nations has at long last admitted its role in causing the worst cholera outbreak in recent history in Haiti that has killed almost 10,000 people to date. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Almost 15 years after the U.S. invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, the Taliban are now active in more of the country than they were in 2001 when the invasion first took place. With the so-called Islamic State now also active, do any prospects for peace look realistic? What is the fate of Afghanistan? We are joined again by Zafar Bangash. He is the director of Contemporary Institute of Islamic Thought in Toronto. Welcome back, Zafar.
It's my pleasure, Brian.
The results of the 2014 Afghan elections were hotly contested. What was the source of the dispute and how was it resolved? And what's playing out now in terms of power struggles?
The 2014 elections were mired by allegations of rigging and so on. I'm sure that those allegations have some element of truth to them. Second, the elections were not held all over the country because the so-called government that exists in Afghanistan does not have control over most parts of the country. Now, as you mentioned in your introduction, the Americans invaded and occupied Afghanistan in 2001. And although outwardly it appeared as if the Americans were successful, And that was primarily because the Taliban did not have any air force or any anti-aircraft missiles or anything like that to confront the American high-altitude bombers. So they just simply melted away and went into the countryside. Now, given that situation, and of course, knowing the character of the Afghan people, they are somebody that who will never, ever accept foreign domination or occupation. It said about the Afghans that they are born fighters. If there are foreign forces in their country, they will fight the foreigners. If the foreign forces leave, then they will fight among themselves. That, regrettably, is the reality of Afghanistan. And what we got out of the 2014 elections was this deep crisis between Ashraf Ghani, who is the current president, and Abdullah Abdullah, who has been given this strange title of chief executive. It is, in fact, an American-crafted arrangement in which they created a donkey with two heads. Now, you can't have a donkey with a head on its actual place and then a head at its tail and then expect that that donkey is going to make progress. And that's what we have come to today. This government is completely dysfunctional. Abdullah Abdullah is very dissatisfied. And in fact, there was a deadline of September, which is coming up next month, under which or at which time the Afghan government was supposed to have had various reforms, political, economic, etc., and to create the post of a prime minister. Now, that has not happened. And of course, this has created deep angst among Abdullah and his supporters, whereas Ashraf Ghani claims that Abdullah is not being sufficiently loyal. He's creating difficulties, problems, etc. So that's where we stand. But of course, Afghanistan is a deeply divided society. Not only do you have the Taliban, you have the ISIS group now entering into the picture. More than that, I think there are two fundamental issues that we need to understand. One is that there is foreign occupation and foreign interference in the internal affairs of the Afghan people. As I said at the beginning, the Afghans don't accept foreign occupation at all. Secondly, Afghanistan is a deeply divided society along tribal lines. So you have the majority Pashtun population that is in the south and southwest of the country. Then you have the Tajiks, to which Abdullah Abdullah belongs. They are in the northeast. And then you have the Uzbeks in the north. And then you have the Hazaras in the central area, etc. So Afghanistan essentially is a patchwork of tribes. And unless and until the interests of all the tribes, including, and in particular, the interests of the majority Pashtun tribes are recognized, then I'm afraid we are not going to have any stability or any kind of normalcy return to Afghanistan.
How might that happen? I mean, when you look at and help our audience, which, of course, except for those parts of the audience that may be Afghans, might not really have any sort of precise understanding of Afghan history. You've gone through this long and tortured struggle during the last few decades. There was the overthrow of the existing government and the coup that brought a socialist government, or a government that said it was a socialist government, in 1978. The United States immediately started to target that government because it was a government that was aligned diplomatically with the USSR, the Soviet Union. The United States at that time supported armed groups like Mujahideen or Osama bin Laden and others to overthrow a socialist-led government. That government, following the collapse, or maybe before the collapse of the Soviet Union, itself collapsed or lost power. Then in the mid-90s, you had the United States sort of exit any sort of participation or direct engagement with Afghanistan following the destruction of that socialist government. And then the Taliban came to power, and they held power not over the entire country, but over the center of it, over Kabul, until 2001. And then the United States invades again. So, I mean, what are the political forces, the military forces, the tribal forces, any of the political forces that might exist that could reconstitute Afghanistan, help Afghanistan move forward?
As I mentioned, because of the tribal nature of Afghanistan, and the fact that the various tribes have to be represented and their interests accommodated in any political arrangement. And this was something that happened prior to 1978 when that coup was brought about. And I think, regrettably, that that was the wrong move. Although the people who came to power, they wanted to bring about various reforms and bring about changes. But you see, reforms can only be successful if the people are willing to accept them. Now, given that the Afghan society is very conservative, it's deeply, deeply conservative. And so when you try to impose any reforms, even if they are well-meaning, they're not going to succeed. And we saw the consequences of that. Even before the Americans got involved, they actually got involved in Afghanistan in a bigger way, not exactly in April of 1978, when the coup was brought about against Sardar Daoud's government. But the U.S. got really deeply involved in somewhere around 1979. And of course, the U.S. wanted to exact revenge from the Soviet Union for America's humiliation in Vietnam. And so they thought this is a good opportunity to settle scores. But the price, of course, has been paid by the Afghan people. Now, what is the solution? I think there is a mechanism in Afghanistan which is referred to as the Loya Jirga, which means the Grand Assembly. Now, the Afghan people historically have used this mechanism to settle their disputes, to resolve their differences, and to work out exactly what is the way forward. And I think this is what is needed. But I'm afraid there are difficulties in that as well, in the sense that the Loya Jirga, or the Grand Assembly, is predicated on the fact that there are tribal leaders. And these tribal leaders are respected by their own tribes. As a consequence of nearly 40 years of war in Afghanistan, that entire structure, the social structure, has been disturbed. So now you have maybe second-tier or third-tier leaders, but they don't enjoy as much support among the population as would have been the case if such disturbances had not occurred. So right now, the way I see it is that unless and until there is some kind of an agreement with the Taliban, whether we like them or not, the fact is that they do enjoy considerable support inside the country. And unless and until they are accommodated, and I'm afraid, you know, there was an effort made, but that was unfortunately sabotaged by certain elements that are aligned with Abdullah Abdullah, because earlier on, Pakistan had convinced the Taliban, and Pakistan does exercise some influence over them. It had convinced them to come to the negotiations with the Afghan government. And last year, that is July of 2015, just a few days prior to another meeting being convened in Pakistan between the Taliban, the Afghan government, the U.S., Pakistan, and China, the Afghan intelligence agency leaked out this information about the death of Mullah Omar, the former Taliban leader, actually the founder of the Taliban movement. When that information was leaked out, this information is something that Pakistan had provided to the Afghan government, but the Afghan intelligence agency, and in particular, I would mention this guy by the name of Amrullah Saleh, who was the former intelligence chief, he did not want any negotiations with the Taliban, because if the Taliban had come to an agreement with the Afghan government, then the Tajik groups would have lost influence in Afghanistan. Now, unfortunately, the Tajik constitute only 20% of the population in Afghanistan, and they're not prepared to, and they actually control the bulk of the resources, the various ministries, the intelligence ministry, etc., in the country. And they don't want to share that power with the others. I think unless and until this is recognized, that you have a majority Pashtun population whose interests have to be recognized, otherwise there is going to be no peace in that country. So that's where the problem lies.
There was a recent private intelligence agency report that said that the Taliban are now active in more parts of Afghanistan than they were prior to September 11th. Is that accurate? Should people be particularly shocked by this report? And another question, Zafar, you mentioned that the Taliban, in spite of whatever one might think of them here, that they enjoy a considerable base of support within the country. Of course, the Taliban is recognized as being fundamentally opposed to women's rights, outlawing the right of girls to go to school. I believe those are accurate reports. So talk about what the Taliban's political orientation is, or theological orientation. Has it changed since October 2001 when the U.S. invaded? And where is their base of support? Where does it come from?
Basically, the Taliban base of support, or the center of their support, is in Kandahar province. And of course, that's where the Taliban leader emerged from. Mullah Omar and the others emerged from Kandahar. Now they have spread it to Helmand province, Nangarhar province, as well as immediately north of Kabul, etc. And they continue to have influence inside Kabul as well. You mentioned the Taliban's position with respect to women's rights and girls' education, etc. All of these things are correct. They are opposed to these things, but that is because of the manner in which that society is structured. But I think we need to understand this issue properly. They're not really opposed to women's rights and girls' education. You see, there is no education in Afghanistan apart from, for instance, a university in Kabul or a few colleges, and then similarly in Jalalabad. But the rest of the country, there is hardly any education that is taking place. So, you know, when people say that the Taliban are opposed to women's education, in fact, I recall just before the Taliban were overthrown in 2001, one of their representatives, this was, I think, about a year or so prior to their overthrow, one of their representatives was visiting the U.S. as well as he went to Europe as well. And he said, look, you people, you foreign people say that we are opposed to girls' education. He said, we beg you to come and establish schools in our country for boys as well as girls, but please don't tell us what to teach them. We are going to teach them. We don't want your values imposed on our people. I mean, this is unfortunately something that foreigners refuse to understand. They continue to interfere in Afghanistan's affairs. Unfortunately, every occupation power has tried to impose its own system on that society. And that is where what lies at the root of the problem. But I'd like to go even a little further, and that is as to why the Americans are over there. Are they over there because they really care about women's education or girls' rights? Surely it would make much more sense if the Americans would turn their attention to Saudi Arabia. It's their ally. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, women are more oppressed than they are in Afghanistan. So what the hell is this whole issue about? It's not about women's education. That's just an excuse. In fact, in the last 15 years, have women's education, women's rights made any improvement at all in Afghanistan? I don't think so. I think we can look at the statistics and see the chaos that America has spread in that country. I mean, America has spent more than $2 trillion on Afghanistan. If in 2001, America had gone into Afghanistan and instead of dropping bombs on the people, if they had simply dropped $2 trillion worth of money on the Afghan people, they would forever be grateful to the Americans. So what have they achieved in these 15 years of warfare? I'll tell you what is at the root of the problem in Afghanistan, and that is that Afghanistan is extremely rich in natural resources. There are, in fact, estimates that the country contains more than $4 trillion worth of natural resources. Let me repeat, $4 trillion. And it includes, it's one of the countries that is very rich in cadmium. Now, cadmium is one of the metals that is widely used in cell phones and modern technology, etc. That is what is really driving American policy. I mean, let's ask ourselves. Last year, Barack Obama had announced that he was going to reduce his forces by this year by 5,500. And yet this year he announced that he was not going to do it. There is no stability over there. We'll continue to, you know, be engaged. We'll continue to have our bases, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if after 15 years of warfare and fighting against the Taliban and trying to train the Afghan National Defense Army, if the Americans have not achieved that level of stability that they can feel comfortable, I don't think another 15 years are going to solve that problem.
Zafar, let me ask you in the last minute and a half, and thank you for that explanation. I think it's extremely important what you've said. The United States is in Afghanistan not to help women, not to help girls' rights. In fact, the bombing of a country that had, in fact, nothing to do with September 11th, has hurt all the people, including, of course, women and girls, and, of course, the entire population. You talked about the riches of Afghanistan. That's the real goal of the American occupation there. Does it appear to you to be in the cards that any American leader is preparing to actually leave Afghanistan?
No, I'm afraid not. You see, we have to understand that American policies are driven by the interests of what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. We can add to that the banksters and the corporations and so on. And of course, you know, when they see, you know, all these riches over there, they don't want to leave these riches either for the Russians or the Chinese or any other outside powers. Like, you know, the Chinese, for instance, have invested about $4 billion in mining, etc. But $4 billion is peanuts compared to $4 trillion. So if that is the situation, I'm afraid I really do not see any American leader willing to withdraw from Afghanistan, unless, of course, American losses mount tremendously. And the fact that the American ground forces are sort of, you know, not in, in the front line anymore, then there will be no internal pressure in the U.S. So I'm afraid Afghanistan's tragedy and the people of Afghanistan's tragedy would continue. And it's a very sad.
Okay, we are completely out of time. We want to thank Zafar Bangash for joining us. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.